You're heading south of the Mason-Dixon. This is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is your host, Brian McClanahan, and we have a very special podcast for you today. This is our 100th episode, so we're going to have a little change of pace, and we're going to do an interview, and I'll get to that in a minute. But before we get started, just want to remind you, if you like this podcast, please share it around on social media. You can find us on social media on Facebook at Abbeville Institute, on Twitter at Abbeville INST, and of course also on YouTube. You can subscribe to our YouTube page. Please consider doing that. Also, if you do like what we do and you want to help us explore what is true and valuable in the Southern tradition, you can make a tax-deductible contribution to the Abbeville Institute. Time is running out for 2017, so if you're making your tax plans, please consider us for a donation for as little as $3 a month or $25 a year if you're a student, or $5 a month or $50 a year if you are not a student. You can help us in our mission, help keep the podcast going, help keep the website up and running, help keep all of our programs going as well. So, as I said, we've got a really interesting podcast today, and I'm going to be interviewing the president of the Abbeville Institute, Don Livingston. Of course, Don Livingston is professor emeritus of philosophy at Emory University. He has been around the South and what's called the Southern Movement for a very long period of time, but of course, the Abbeville Institute is his baby, and so I thought for a special change of pace and in honor of our 100th podcast, we would talk to Don. So let's go ahead and get started. Well, this is a real treat. We've got Don Livingston, again, as I mentioned at the beginning, on our 100th episode. So, Don, thanks for being on the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute.
Thank you, Brian.
Well, I wanted to talk to you today because a lot of people question, you know, why is the Institute around? Why was it founded? How was it founded? You know, we do this podcast, and I've done 99 of these episodes, and so we've gotten a lot of listeners that way. But can you talk about the Institute, why you founded it, when it was founded, that type of thing?
Well, yes. I was raised in the South, but I'm not a historian, and really we weren't taught too much about the Southern tradition, really at all. We just grew up in the South absorbing the culture and had that Southern identity. I went on to study philosophy and taught at Emory University and didn't think much about the South until I began to see the region being trashed by academics and the media. In the 80s, I began to think about this. I began to look into it. And it was amazing what I discovered. I didn't realize, for example, that that New England states had considered secession from 1803 to about 1814. And that most Americans thought states could secede. And I thought, well, if that's the case, and why was there such a heavy weather about the South seceding? And why didn't I know this? And I was in my 40s. I'm just now learning that secession was widely considered an option available to an American state. This was appalling. I mean, if that was true, and it is true, here was something of great importance for understanding America that I didn't know anything about. So I began to look into it, and the more I looked into it, the more I realized that I was studying a foreign country. I wasn't studying the United States as I understood it to be. So a number of scholars had begun to think this way, Southerners mainly, and we formed a society, a conference at the University of Virginia in 2002, hosted by one of the deans there, and it was on the Southern tradition and modernity. And at the end of that conference, we decided to form the Abbeville Institute. And the purpose was to have a voice in higher education, to educate college students and graduate students, and to educate academics, professors in the liberal arts. And that was our mission. We were small, in that time, about 15 years ago, I guess maybe 16, 16, We have 15 of our students have their doctorates. We didn't give the doctorates, but there were students that we had that went on to get doctorates, and a number of them are working on their doctorates now. So that's what we wanted to do, was to take college students and provide them from with a different perspective, we think a more comprehensive perspective, and try to do something about reviving what's valuable about our culture.
Well, you say that. Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, okay. Please.
Well, no, you say that that part of it, what's valuable about our culture, you talk about the Institute, or when we go out in public and we do things for the public, like this podcast or our website or our programs.
Yes.
What purpose do you see the Institute fulfilling in the 21st century? You know, you talk about the 80s and how it was awful. Of course, it's only gotten worse. So what do you see the Institute doing for Southerners or America as a whole moving into the 21st century?
Well, I think there are two things. One, the Southern people are a real thing. I mean, there was a book that argued that the South is the largest ethnic group in America. Southerners are an ethnic group. That's not how people think today. But some people do. But it is. It's a large ethnic group. It's an identifiable people. Not only that, but the South was the most important region in forming the United States from 1776 to 1861, when South Carolina seceded. Only five presidents were from the North, and no Northern president up to 1861 ever served two terms. But five Southern presidents served two terms. All the territory that was acquired beyond the 13 colonies or states was acquired by Southern administrations. Southerners dominated speakers of the House, of the justices, chief justices of the Supreme Court. When you thought of America and the antebellum period, you thought mainly of Southerners. But Madison, Jefferson, Monroe, Washington, Jackson, the Alamo, that's what you thought of. Polk. After the war, after 1865, when you think of America, you think of Northerners. So we have two Americas. We have a highly decentralized, I'll call it Jeffersonian America, in which people believe that states are sovereign, they can secede, they can interpose to nullify unconstitutional and lawless acts of the central government. And then after that, you have a Lincolnian America, where states cannot interpose, they cannot secede, and where the central government is self-centralizing. There's no power outside itself to limit its ability to centralize power. So those are two quite different Americas. And philosophically, you can ask yourself the question, which is the better sort of arrangement? And people differ on this. There are people who like empires. They like massively centralized regimes. But then there are other people, like the Swiss and Southerners, who prefer something more decentralized, more tied to a human scale. So the South is the bearer of that decentralist tradition. It existed in the North as well as the South prior to the war between the states, because, as I said, Southerners dominated the central government, and they couldn't dominate it unless Northerners elected them. And Northerners elected them because they, too, believed in this Jeffersonian decentralist way of life. So the Republican Party in 1861, when Lincoln took power, was a revolutionary party, and it transformed America through that war. So the critique of centralization is one of the great achievements of the South. And let me say something about how universal that is, because from the late Middle Ages on, there were thoughtful Europeans who criticized centralization. That was the problem with monarchs. They got larger and larger and larger, and they centralized more power. They took over banking. They took over religion. They took over. They tried to take over most everything. But they, as bad as they were, none of them have been able to take over as much as the United States has, or modern so-called democratic states. So this critique of centralization, which began in the late Middle Ages, came to America, but Europe, from the 17th century on, Europe adopted the path of centralization. That became the wave of the future. It was fiercely resisted in Europe, but the decentralists were defeated, and the centralists came to dominate. And so hundreds and hundreds of smaller states crushed into these big centralized monarchies. America resisted. That's what the colonies were doing. They were seceding from this trend of centralization. They said, no, we'll not have it. And the first constitution they made, the Articles of Confederation, was highly decentralized. The central government couldn't even tax individuals. It had to get permission from the states. America continued to develop this theory of decentralization. And the South was the leader in that. And so if you want to study this tradition of decentralization, there's no place better than the South. No country in Europe developed thought of equality. You have Calhoun and Jefferson and John Taylor, Abel Hubscher, and other Southern writers. This is a great gift the South has for the world. And now it's beginning to be recognized. Our Pledge of Allegiance is Lincolnian. It says we are one nation, indivisible. And what that means is you cannot criticize the central government outside itself. In other words, it's a self-centralizing thing. It can't be divided. There's no criticism that can come from outside it. That's a kind of billiard ball. But that is not the case anymore. You know, Britain secedes from the European Union. Scotland nearly seceded from England or from Britain. But I'll stop here. You were going to say something.
Well, no, I wanted bridging off of that. You know, and that's absolutely part of this Southern tradition that we think is true and valuable, and that's our mission. You had a conference back, I think you said in the 1990s, you told me, on secession, and no one showed up. And so what is it? Why have Americans forgotten this, do you think? I mean, you know, you look at Europeans, and of course we talk about the disintegration of the Soviet Union, how that actually took place. You had secession, you had states seceding from the Soviet Union, and all Americans stood up and applauded that, and that was great. But now when you look at different types of secession movements, you have your Catalonia and Spain, and so many Americans have said this is a bad idea, or you've got Brexit, which you talked about, and these things are universally condemned, really, in the United States. Why is it that Americans, you think, have forgotten this very important part of our own tradition?
Well, I don't think they are universally condemned today. Unless I misunderstand you.
If you look at the establishment, you know, and you look at
the establishment does
right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, the establishment. See, let's put it this way: the modern state begins in the 17th century, and it's a centralized state, one and indivisible. And what this means is there's no independent social authorities within it. You just have central authority plus individuals in it that are ruled. And Britain's this way, France is this way, Germany wasn't, but Hitler made it that way, and the Soviet Union and so on. And Lincoln did that with the United States. So this is modernity. This is the modern state. This is the way things are supposed to be. That's why we have have this Pledge of Allegiance, the one nation indivisible. That was put in to make clear there'll be no secession, no division. No matter how bad things get, you cannot divide it. So that was the normal way of thinking. Southerners were part of this tradition in Europe, going back to the late Middle Ages, that argued against this. They weren't the only ones. And this is a long tradition of arguing against this centralization, which they saw as the Tower of Babel. Remember the biblical story of the Tower of Babel?
Absolutely.
Human beings decided they would build this tower up to heaven, and they centralized everything. And God looked down and said, this is not good. And so what did he do? He confounded their languages. So they had to go off and live in different countries because they couldn't keep on with the centralization. So when the colonies seceded, they were fighting the Tower of Babel. And when Southerners seceded, they were fighting the Tower of Babel. When Britain seceded from the European Union, it was fighting the Tower of Babel. And so we have this struggle going on. So it's important for Southerners and anybody else to understand that we have the honor of having developed this centralist tradition more thoughtfully than any other region. Now, when I took up this topic of secession, and I told you I was pretty ignorant about it. In 1990s, Soviet Union secedes in 1991. So I go to the Philosopher's Index, which publishes all articles in philosophy from 1940 to today in five languages. And I look up articles with the word secession in it, and there are only seven. There was only one book written on secession. It just come out. It was called Secession, from Fort Sumter to Lithuania. It was about the breakup of the Soviet Union. And five of the seven articles on secession were book reviews of that book. And the other two articles were on Quebec, which had recently decided not to secede. So here are philosophers who have written about every conceivable thing. And as Cicero said, there's nothing so absurd that some philosopher hasn't written about it. They hadn't talked about secession. Why haven't they talked about secession? They've raised the question whether time is real, whether other people exist, whether physical objects exist. They didn't raise the question because every one of them, most of them, had assumed that political order is necessarily the modern state. And it's one and indivisible, so there's nothing to write about. Why write about secession when the state is indivisible? Anyway, that began to change, and some of myself and others began to write on secession when other people weren't doing it. And that was kind of exciting because we had the market to ourselves. So I was invited with another scholar who had written on secession to give a paper at the American Philosophical Association in one of its sessions. And so we had this session on secession, and nobody showed up. I was there and a friend, and the other speaker was there with his friend, and so we decided just to go to lunch. And why did nobody show up? Well, because philosophers they were caught in this framework of one and indivisible. Well, that's changed. Britain was indivisible, but Scotland nearly seceded. European Union, indivisible. Britain seceded. Soviet Union was officially said in its national anthem to be indivisible. 15 states seceded. Mm-hmm. And the modern state is a myth, and yet it's hard for people to see it. So one of the great things about the South is that we understood this. Well, not just the South, but the North and the South understood it when the Jeffersonians were running things up to 1861. We all understood this. We lost that understanding after the war between the states. The South lost it too. And we in the Institute are regaining an understanding of that.
Well, so politically, you know, the Southern political tradition obviously is one thing that we do a lot of. But you mentioned that the South is an ethnic group, a nation in the
yes.
traditional definition of that. And so when you look at
yeah.
this, again, our charge to explain what is true and valuable in the Southern tradition. Outside of the political tradition, what else can the South offer? I mean, I've often said on the podcast, the South is America, and I know you've said that before too. So culturally, what is in Southern culture that is still valuable for America today?
Well, I wouldn't say the South is America. I think America is such a contested thing today. It's always been contested, but especially today. I think the South was America from 1776 to 1861, and even up to say, you know, the 1940s. The South was considered what was normal in America. That's why the Confederacy was appreciated even after the war. But I think the second thing that's important about this, the permanent thing that's important about the South, as well as its decentralized tradition, is its literature. If you want to understand a people, if you want to understand who are the Elizabethan English, who are these people, who are the Victorians, read Shakespeare. And Victorian England will come alive. That's what it was. Read the Victorian writers. Read, you know, Tennyson, Dickens, and those people. They reveal the culture and the people of that era. And so Southern literature is beyond, I think, any question, the greatest literature America has produced. Clyde Wilson once ventured to say that, you know, hundreds of years from now, when everything else America has produced is gone, as will happen, one thing that will remain will be its literature. That may be true. He thought that was true. So I would say its literature is one of the great achievements of the South.
Well, I mean, I think that's absolutely, you know, when you look at what we do and the things we publish, and we talk a lot about literature. In fact, on the website this week, we had a new poem by David Middleton. And so we've got some great, even current scholars that are doing some fantastic work in that area. Now, one thing you did talk about, though, and I want to touch on one in a little more detail. You mentioned how in the 1980s things were bad, but it's gotten so much worse. And so What is the difference now, at least in terms of the academy and how the South is? You look at 1980s and how the South was taught in the academy, and you look at 2017 and how the South is taught in the academy. So, you know, what's changed there? And I know this might be an obvious question, but I think getting into that a little more, it would help explain to people, you know, how we've gotten to where we are. And we're only talking 30 years, but so much has changed even in 30 years from the time you were teaching now. So what's happened?
Before I try to venture into that, let me say there's one thing we left out, and that's music. So I would say the decentralized tradition and political thought, literature, and music. I mean, if you took the South out, you would have taken the guts out of music in America. What the blacks and whites in the South have produced is really stunning. But now back to your question. I watched all this happen. I began teaching in the late 60s, and the university was prided itself on being a liberal arts place, liberal in the old sense. It wasn't always liberal in the old classical sense, but it certainly claimed to be and held that up as a standard. And now there's very little pretense of that. What happened? Well, I think it may help to realize that what we're looking at today is happening in Europe, too. In other words, it's not just that in America we have political correctness and that the academy has become politicized beyond anything we could have imagined. Even in the 60s were bad, but it's worse because it extends to the faculty now and the administration. And one reason for that is the students of the 60s are now the deans and presidents and administrators and the faculty. But it's a transatlantic thing, and it's going on in Europe too. You've got PC there as well. So then the question is, well, what's the source of that? And I don't know that I can say too much about that except to say that what was the source of Marxism in Europe? What was the source of, Nazism? It's a spiritual disorder. I mean, it's not just, you can't explain Marxism by economics. You can't say, well, the workers had it rough and the Marxists came along and tried to do something about it. that doesn't help at all. There's something in human nature that was a lie. It's called the left. You have the left emerging with the French Revolution. That's where we get those terms, the left and right. It starts with the French Revolution. And they're those who want to build a utopia on Earth. They have a vision of a society which is so clear to them, is so real to them, and they get impatient that it's not established, and they want a shortcut to it, and they have to imagine that somebody's stopping it. If they can believe that, then they can have a shortcut, because they can eliminate that. In the case of Marx, it was the capitalist class. And that's stopping us to the shortcut. So we get rid of that, we'll be okay. Today it's racism and sexism and homophobia. And those have to be eradicated. And of course, they're defined in such broad, vacuous ways that there's no way to get rid of sexism, because once you get rid of sexism defined one way, they up the ante. And it becomes an ever-receding goal. And it destroys, destroys, destroys. That way of thinking is, you could say, it goes back to the devil's resistance against God, if we want to really get back with it. The devil was the first, Samuel Johnson said, the devil was the first Whig. The devil was the first leftist. He was the first leftist. So there's this sort of metaphysical rebellion built into human beings, and some people get addicted by it and some don't. And one of the great things, one of the good things about the South is the Southerners have had an immunity to this somehow in their DNA, going back to the 17th century. They were never perfect in it, but they had a pretty good constitution to be able to tell the difference between cow dung and oatmeal. That they could smell ideology and see that there was nothing to it. I know my father used to tell me, son, don't ever get carried away. That was one of his motto. So I was raised on that. So I think it's this penchant for ideology. It has, in the prior to World War II, the left was obsessed with class, rich and poor. And they romanticized the Southerners because they had pellagra, they were poor, and the blacks, and the they didn't care about the blacks much, but it was the Dust Bowl people. They romanticized the music of the of poor Southerners and poor people. After World War II, since the Nazis made such a bad use of race, they got on race. And all of a sudden, they didn't care about the poor Southerners anymore. They were just racists. All the poor Southerners were racist. And the Dust Bowl people were racist. And they began to romanticize race. And then they got on gender. So if they get through with gender and race, there'll be something else that this spirit will go after. But that's where we are now.
Well, all of that said, and I think just we're getting to the end here, but I guess the question that a lot of people have, and that they're anxious, you know, they look around, they don't know what to do. They see all these things happening, they see all their world crumbling down, they see all of their great heroes under attack, you know, whether it's a Confederate hero, even George Washington, or and one of the things we yes. try to do with the Institute is, and you have talked about it in this particular interview, is the South and what you know Braudel called the long durée, you know, this long view of history. And so,
yes.
Do you think? And I think this is a question that people often had: will the South survive? I know Clyde wrote about it in the early 1980s. He actually had a book under that title. But will the South survive? And so, you know, what parts of it will survive? And I think you mentioned, you know, the culture, but
it's the civilization. Well, the South of the 18th century is gone. That whole way of life is gone. The South of 1820 is gone. South of 1860 is gone. South of 1880 is gone. South of 1840 is gone. I mean, all these Souths disappear. Mm-hmm. So what remains? What remains? What remains is a tradition. What was passed down, ideas, literature, And those things remain. Greek civilization is gone. It's gone with the wind. And yet, students in philosophy read Plato and Aristotle and the Stoics. They read these books because they're timeless. You see, so is Greek civilization dead? Look at the architecture. How many Greek columns do you see in Roman? All of our state buildings are Greek and Roman. And we could go on and on to see the degree to which Greek and Roman civilizations embedded in our jokes, our humor, our literature, and all the rest of it. So the South will survive in that sense. Its literature will survive. Its decentralist critique of the Tower of Babel will survive. I don't get depressed about, I mean, I do get depressed about these things in one way, but I guess because I have a philosophic outlook on things, having studied philosophy for so long, that I see the permanent things, and they're going to survive. They're going to survive. The Southern people may become so, many Southerners don't even know what their tradition is anymore, and that's unfortunate. But that doesn't mean those traditions are going to perish. And they can be revived. I mean, there's such a thing as a Renaissance. There are revolutions that occur. And these revolutions usually are just cases where people all of a sudden recover something they had forgotten, something that they had ignored, something that had been suppressed. They take it, they look at it again, and they start a new way of life built out of that. Which is different, but it also is continuous with what they rediscovered. I'm not optimistic, but I don't get too worried about it.
Well, I think when you mentioned the Greeks, you know, that's a nice example. And I remember I heard one time with the Greeks, their greatest parts have become part of us. And so, you know, we live in a world that, as you said, that's so influenced by the Greeks, and maybe some of the great Southern thinkers and philosophers and literary figures, maybe that will become, you know, fully ingrained into American society. And if we have anything to do with it at the Abbey Bill Institute, hopefully that will happen. Well, Don, thanks for being on the program, and we appreciate you coming on in this very special podcast.
Well, thank you, Brian. I appreciate it. Thanks for the opportunity.